Spiked is free, and it always will be. There's no paywall, no subscriptions. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to do that, we need your help. If you support the work that we do here, why not become a regular donor? Just £5 per month will keep us going, even in these uncertain times. To do so, just go to spiked-online.com and click on the big red donate button. Whatever you can give is greatly appreciated, especially given all that's going on in the world. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. This is a show all about freedom, the nanny state, and censorship. And these days, there's a lot about coronavirus too. In this episode, we look at the good news for a change. From the demise of Public Health England to the end of South African prohibition, from the return of the turkey Twizzler to Sweden's triumph over its haters. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, Deputy Editor of Spiked, and today, as ever, I'm joined by the writer, researcher and the author of Polemics, Chris Snowden. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Tom.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Rob Lyons. Rob is a Spiked columnist. He's the Science and Technology Director at the Academy of Ideas, and he's also the author of Panic on a Plate, How Society Developed an Eating Disorder. Hello, Rob. How are you doing?
Hi, Tom. Not bad.
Great. So today we're going to do something a little bit different, a bit of a good news episode, because amid all of the gloom of 2020, there's actually been quite a good run of news recently, especially from the perspective of anti-nanny state obsessives like Rob and Chris here. So we're going to talk a little bit about the return of turkey Twizzlers, South Africa lifting its booze ban, and more. But first, let's get to the big one, I think, which is Public Health England and its impending demise. So Public Health England has pretty much been the bane of Rob and Chris's existence. It was set up in 2013. It's to be no more. Matt Hancock, the health secretary, has announced it will be wound down, replaced with a new National Institute for Health Protection focused on pandemics and infectious diseases rather than a lot of the lifestyle stuff it became obsessed with, or PHE became obsessed with in recent years. So a lot of this has come in response to its handling of coronavirus, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but also no doubt there's been a lot of discussion about its skew towards nanny state issues in recent years. So Chris, to kick us off, where were you when you heard the news? How did you feel? Tell us a little bit about your response to this.
Well, no one will ever forget where they were when they heard that Public Health England was to be abolished, or that I, like most people, was sat in front of the computer. I watched Hancock's speech, actually, when he was announcing it. And it was interesting in that speech, he makes a clear distinction between health protection and health improvement. And I haven't heard anyone really, certainly not in politics, make that distinction before. But it's one that we've often made on the podcast, I've often made in my writing, that, you know, public health is a very, very broad church. It's far too broad. And its core business is things like preparing and dealing with coronavirus. And for years, it was much more interested in deciding how many calories there were in sponge cake and so on. So it's fantastic news that it's been disbanded. It's exactly what I've been calling for. Replace it with an infectious disease centre. Absolutely right. I'm sure that things won't turn out as well as I would like them to, and they never do. But just rejoice at that news, as Maggie Thatcher said, when we reclaimed South Georgia.
And Rob, what was your response to all this?
It's a blow to the public health types, the campaigns and whatever, because it was Public Health England was just so into what they wanted to do and all these campaigns. I'm sure the nanny state isn't going to go away because this news comes obviously just a few weeks after the new obesity strategy. So the inclination to interfere in our lifestyles and micromanage what we do and keep us away, like with the advertising bans and everything, keep even the sight of the wrong kind of food away from us, that hasn't gone away, and it will rear its ugly head again in different ways, no doubt. But nonetheless, just from the point of view even of dealing with issues like coronavirus, this has got to be good news, because an organisation which has the responsibility for those genuinely public health issues that is so distracted by micromanaging us, it's not going to be very effective. And it is absolutely demonstrated its complete uselessness in the first few months of this pandemic, because it didn't organise the testing properly. It gave away all the wrong advice on a variety of different things, and it couldn't even keep count of the number of deaths properly. So good riddance and farewell. And hopefully that in the future, at least when we get a situation like this, we'll have an organisation that is in a position to deal with it more effectively than Public Health England ever has.
Mm. And Chris, on the coronavirus stuff specifically, what do you think was its kind of key failing going throughout all of this? Because as Rob said, there's loads there. There's the testing question. There's how they count the deaths. There's the advice. But what in particular do you think really exposed how unprepared or just incapable of dealing with this pandemic PHE was?
There were five or six things, but I think maybe the main one was the testing and the tracing. I mean, the two are obviously very closely linked. You can't do the tracing if you've not got the testing capacity. And we didn't have it because they didn't roll it out and they made a conscious decision to stop contact tracing just as the virus was really getting going. So I think that's the main thing. I think the thing that broke the camel's back was the failure to even count the deaths properly. And that wasn't a lethal mistake, but it really did illustrate how incompetent this organization was. I mean, it was such a schoolboy error. They were doing it. They could have copied the rest of the UK. You know, every other part of the UK did it in a more sane way. They chose not to. I mean, just loads of things about it. They were never public facing. The CEO was totally AWOL the entire time because he doesn't know anything about virology or even medicine particularly. People are saying, you know, oh, Public Health England's been used as a scapegoat. And I wouldn't deny that the government is looking to apportion blame. But you're not a scapegoat when you're guilty. You know, it doesn't just count being a scapegoat when you've actually done it. They are absolutely culpable for some very, very major mistakes. And they should go. And we're celebrating largely because, you know, we don't like all their nanny state stuff as well. But they were incompetent at that as well. You know, they've been incompetent since day one. Their approach to obesity, even if you think that the government should be getting involved in what we eat, their approach was ridiculously incompetent, as Josie Appleton showed very clearly in an IEA report last year. They don't know what they're doing. And a lot of people will stay at PHE. A lot of the real scientists who actually do good work fairly quietly, while the more public-facing people in PHE are making ludicrous statements about our diet or smoking, they'll stay, and that's okay. They'll just change the letterheads. And it'd be a bit disorganization, you know, while things have changed around. And it's not ideal, I guess, to do it in the middle of a pandemic, but it wouldn't happen otherwise. You've got to grasp these opportunities when they arise. I hope the same thing happens with the World Health Organization, but it won't. So, no, they're not scapegoats. They're bang to rights. And I just hope that the government doesn't decide to form a twin organization to do all the nanny state stuff. But I guess it'll be pressured into thinking it has to create something as a vehicle for all this nanny state stuff as well.
And Rob, for people who might not be as aware of PHE's exploits, could you just give us a little sense of some of the more ludicrous, or at least some of the more illiberal things it was doing in the years running up to the pandemic in relation to lifestyle and all the rest of it?
The death of PHE, one of the big groups that will suffer from this is the advertising industry, because the number of half-assed campaigns that they ran, Change for Life, One You, all this sort of stuff that's like, you know, one fun family-friendly thing after another to try and make us stop eating the wrong thing. There was plenty of that, so that there'll have been tears in the PR and advertising industries over that kind of thing. I think more importantly, PHE was not acting as a proper government department following government policy. It was actually lobbying for things as well. Duncan Selby, the aforementioned CEO, who sadly is now going to be continuing his work overseas, wrote a blog post about how we need to have a tobacco-free UK. And that's just not the role of Public Health England. Chris has written a chapter and verse on sock puppets, and essentially this was PHE was acting like a sock puppet, repeating back to government the policy that it wanted to hear so that it could have justification for the policies it wanted to pursue, as well as being an activist organisation in itself. And that's just fundamentally inappropriate. And at least the demise of PHE may for a little while put that on the back foot, but no doubt the lobbyists will be back in a new form at some point in the future.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. So in an attempt to keep the mood up in this good news episode, let's move on to something which was definitely will have upset Jamie Oliver very seriously recently, and that's the return of Turkey Twizzlers. So after 15 years off our shelves, famously kind of got rid of after Jamie Oliver's crusade against this horrendous alleged junk food, Bird and Matthews has brought back those glorious corkscrew-shaped treats once beloved of school children. So the new Twizzlers, they're healthier than the previous ones, we're told, with a turkey content that's actually nudged above 50%, which is not like it was the first time around, but it still sparked consternation naturally amongst all the usual suspects, people in the nanny state blob having a go at Bernard Matthews for putting out this notorious product in the middle of this public health crisis. I think they even put up a kind of statue of a Twizzler outside their headquarters as a bit of a troll. So, Rob, can you tell us a bit of the backstory about this? Because the turkey Twizzler has had a very central role almost in our kind of culture war over food in this country in recent decades.
The turkey Twizzler, it just became the lightning rod, as it were, a spiral-shaped lightning rod for the whole campaign around Jamie's school dinners, which was about 2004, 2005. Basically, Jamie, the crusading Mockney chef, going into schools and trying to change the way people ate. And he latched upon the turkey Twizzler, which is kind of for those of you who don't live in the UK, it's kind of like a spiral-shaped turkey sausage, which at the time was mostly like pork fat with very little real turkey content. I'd never actually come across them myself until the Today programme of all came round to the Spiked office when I worked there and asked Brendan O'Neill to try some turkey Twizzlers, sort of recorded his reaction to them, and we had no means of actually heating them up except a microwave. So microwave turkey Twizzlers, what an appetizing thing. They just actually look like spiral feces, basically. but he munched them and pretended to enjoy it. But actually, school kids at the time, we actually had interns sort of after this who had been in school at the time, and they were livid about the demise of the turkey Twizzler. It was one of the top most popular school dinners around because it actually tasted something. So they were very, very disappointed. Bernard Matthews scrapped them. Poor old Bernard died in 2010 and never saw the return of the turkey Twizzler, which I'm sad to say has become a healthy meal now with the actually putting some turkey into it and reducing the fat content. But nonetheless, just the totemic value of the return of the turkey Twizzler just to piss off Jamie Oliver, it was a joy in itself, really.
Chris, what were your thoughts on all this?
Well, yeah, absolutely agree. I mean, it's just, this has been a bad year, but there have been good things happening, you know. So now Jamie Oliver is obese, basically. His restaurants have all gone bust and turkey Twizzlers are coming back. And I never had a turkey Twizzler, but I mean, I can't wait to have one. I'm certainly going to introduce my daughter to them. But they must have been fan-bloody-tastic because millennials never shut up about them. At any given day over the last 10 years, you could type in turkey Twizzlers into Twitter and it would be millennials in the last hour or two still say how much they miss them or how much they hate Jamie Oliver as a result of him getting rid of them. I'm concerned, like Rob, that they've been reformulated. They might have a bit too much turkey in it, 60%. Maybe it was better at 35% and it was the pork fat that really made them. But I will see. I will give them a go. I'll look at the traffic light labelling. This is where traffic light labelling really comes into its own. As long as it's red for salt and fat, then I'm in. But yeah, it's great symbolically, and I believe it will be great nutritionally because apparently they are staggeringly nice. Have you ever had them, Tom? Were you too old?
No, they were delicious. School or?
You had them, yeah.
My suspicion, though, it's the low actual meat content that made them so delicious. So I would be slightly concerned as to this new recipe. But Rob, do you think we've seen kind of similar things recently, although a little bit more immediate in relation to companies like Iron Brew, who kind of originally, you know, reformulate in the face of pressure or in the face of the sugar tax, etc. But do you think there's kind of at least companies are starting to realise that even though some of these things are branded as junk food and they're told by government and lobbyists that they're horrendous, that there is a market for these things and maybe they should provide for them? Do you think that we're starting to see companies just kind of stick up for themselves on that basis a little bit, actually provide these products?
Wherever these things occur, it's usually because big corporations spend too much time paying attention to what's being said by public health monks on Twitter or lobbyists rather than actually listening to their customers. And when they do listen to their customers, they have enough sense to push back against this stuff. You know, notably, the people who didn't reformulate their drinks, or at least their major brands, were Coca-Cola and Pepsi. They kept it full sugar. Coca-Cola had already had the debacle of New Coke back in the 80s and decided that they weren't going to mess around with it, and good to them, because that's what their customers want. They want the taste of sugar in their Coca-Cola. They do not want the taste of aspartame.
So on that note, let's move on and talk about, it was a horrendous story, but a nice sight to see the country come out of it, which is South Africa lifting its ban on alcohol and cigarettes. Actually lifting its second ban. There was another one that had been already lifted in July. This was originally kind of presented as a response from the South African government to coronavirus, an attempt to make people kind of healthier in response to the pandemic. They claim that it's had all sorts of huge benefits in relation to everything from road accidents through to actual health. But of course, as Chris has written about on Spikes and elsewhere, it's had horrendous consequences as well. So Chris, it's a good sign that South Africa are coming out of this. You know, you saw queues around the block at various places with people stocking up on cigarettes and alcohol. But do you want to tell us a little bit about the background to this and how the government ended up pursuing such a liberal policy in response to this pandemic?
The government brought the ban on tobacco and alcohol in basically because it could. There were people in public health presumably pushing them for this, and they thought, why not give it a whirl when everyone's locked down? And it was enforced for quite a while, at least a couple of months, and then it was rescinded to the great joy of the South African people. And then within a few weeks, it was back in again because they had a second wave, or they really just had a continuation of the first wave. They locked down when there were hardly any deaths from COVID, actually. Since then, under prohibition, they've had the worst outbreak in Africa, one of the worst outbreaks in the world. So the idea that banning tobacco and alcohol reduces your rate of COVID death is not obviously confirmed by the South African experience. And why would it? You know, it was quite difficult to get some evidence out of the government as to why they banned either of these commodities. I think it was a health minister stood up at a press conference and she said that she'd had letters from doctors, and that was her evidence, but she didn't have the letters with her at the time, so she couldn't show them to the journalists. Which, yeah, I mean, the idea that getting a letter from a doctor counts as evidence is ridiculous in the first place, and then to fail to even bring these mythical letters along with you. It's kind of pathetic. So they came up with various sort of ad hoc justifications. They were saying, well, if people get drunk, then they'll go out partying, and then they'll spread COVID, and it's kind of plausible in a way. Except people were literally locked down, you know. I mean, if you've got a lockdown, then, you know, keep people locked down. And, of course, people went out and about to get illicit tobacco and alcohol on the black market and probably met more people than they would have done otherwise. And there was never really any justification for the tobacco thing at all. They just said, look, smoking's bad for you and people would be better off not doing it.
Rob, what are your thoughts on this? Because this isn't the only example of COVID being the kind of excuse for a lot of prohibitionist policies being pursued, either on a grand scale like this or things that have been a little bit smaller in scale. So, yeah, what are your thoughts on all that?
Three things occur to me. One is that how utterly corrupt the ANC is, the ANC government, because it's, I mean, they can't even keep the lights on, but it's, admittedly, the Californian government can't do that either these days, but they can't even keep the lights on. The idea that this is that somehow the People's Party has now been, has been refuted time and time again, and this is absolutely what out of touch people do. They impose their prejudices upon the populace when they stay in power for too long and they're unaccountable. Also, I mean, there's a lot of talk about decolonization at the moment, decolonize education. I mean, I wrote an article the other day about somebody demanding that we decolonize light, but the, whatever the hell that means.
How does one decolonize light? Not to get sidetracked.
Well, I really don't know. I mean, I couldn't make head or tail of the postmodern justification that he made for it. But one of the worst aspects of this pandemic is the way in which actually governments in developing countries have actually just blindly copied what's been happening in the developed world, which was bad enough anyway. But if you're in a developing country and an awful lot of your population does casual work as the only means of survival and you lock down the economy, that's absolutely terrible. And again, so imposing these kind of the middle class values of developed countries onto a very poor country is even worse than smoking bans in Spain or whatever. I mean, this is just this punitive relationship that the South African government has with its populace from what I can see. So, I mean, the whole thing is terrible. As Chris says, no health benefits whatsoever, and actually just encourages the black market and all the problems that come with that.
And Chris, I know you wrote an article for The Telegraph about some of these other examples of people using COVID to push through these kinds of policies and just how ridiculous that is. Do you want to tell us about some of those, the other kind of case studies in COVID nanny state kind of authoritarianism?
Rob's just mentioned Spain banning smoking outdoors, which was justified on the basis that smokers might exhale droplets into the air, which could contain coronavirus, which of course is true, but obviously non-smokers do this as well. I mean, this is just how, you know, paper thin these justifications are. It's so obvious that they're just doing what they always wanted to do. It's laughable. It treats people with contempt, really, if you think they're going to believe something like that. The same was true in Manchester. They banned smoking in the outdoor areas of pubs there, which I'm sure is smashing on a day like this. It's a thunderstorm and rain today as we record this. I'm sure the non-smokers are taking full advantage. There's the anti-vaping thing in America. So this terrible study came out recently based on an online survey, and somehow they managed to come up with the claim that vapers are 5 times more likely to develop coronavirus. I don't know how they did this. It's contrary to all the other evidence. But it was immediately seized on by American politicians as justification for banning the sale of vapor products totally for at least the duration of the pandemic. There are other examples. I mean, there are countless examples. There's, you know, activists all over the place are seizing on this as an excuse to bring in all their pet policies, and they are getting away with it. And the obvious example, of course, in Britain being all this stuff about food, the you know, food advertising ban and the promotion ban and the half price pizza ban. This is stuff that, as we said last month, it's been on the radar for 4 or 5 years, but it took COVID to provide the opportunity for them to introduce it.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So we've heard a lot recently about how various things are fueling COVID cases. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about junk food and obesity in this country, the new obesity strategy, how we all need to get fit and stop eating so much in order to protect ourselves from a second wave. But we've actually heard precious little about how another vice, smoking, might actually be helping. So Chris, this is something that we've talked about a bit on the podcast before, about how some of the data that was coming out originally seemed to suggest that smokers were at least underrepresented among cases as well as hospitalizations. But I understand that there's been even more studies and research done since. So do you want to tell us a little bit about where we're at in relation to smoking and coronavirus?
Yeah, the evidence just keeps on coming. I mean, it was reported a little bit in kind of March, April, that smokers are underrepresented in COVID wards. But there's been loads of studies since, much better ones, actually, and stronger ones. I was, to be honest, always fairly skeptical about this. It didn't seem obvious that smoking was going to help people either fight off or not get a respiratory disease. But it was good fun to talk about and wind up public health people. But now it's, I mean, I'm coming around to thinking that there really is something in this. There's been a number of studies in the course of late July, August. The biggest one yet in Mexico found significant reduction in smokers getting COVID. And that seems to be the key. Initially, it seemed to be, well, there are fewer smokers in intensive care. Maybe once you've got the virus, something about the nicotine helps you fight it off or something. It does seem pretty clear now that if there is an effect, it is on stopping smokers get it in the first place. This big Mexican study confirmed that. There was a big study elsewhere in Heart, the medical journal Heart, it was published in, 20,000 people, again, significant reduction of the virus amongst smokers. And there's a study in The Lancet, ecological study, that showed that countries where the smoking rate was higher, rates of COVID were lower. But I think most impressively and most compellingly was the zero prevalence test, the immunity test that looked at how many people had antibodies in Britain, which doesn't give you an exact estimate of the number of people who have actually had the virus necessarily, but it's a very good proxy for it. And that study found smokers underrepresented are about 36% less likely to have had the virus already. Now, that seems to me very difficult to explain in any other way other than something about smoking really does protect you from the virus. Mm-hmm. So I think if this was anything else, if this was evidence showing that smoking caused COVID or maybe more likely to get it or more likely to get anything, it would at this point be established scientific fact in the eyes of public health. You may recall back in March when Public Health England claimed that smokers are 14 times more likely to develop COVID symptoms based on a study that had 5 smokers in it. You know, this evidence now is really mounted up and it needs to be taken seriously, not because public health agencies should encourage people to start smoking. They're obviously never going to do that. But if it's just something in the nicotine, then this really potentially gives us an important weapon against this virus.
And Rob, what do you make of all this?
Like Chris, at first I thought it was a great bounce to have this. There are biologically plausible mechanisms by which nicotine could actually interfere with this virus taking hold in your body, which I don't pretend to understand, but they sound perfectly plausible to me. And actually, in terms of the intensive care cases, one of the points that I read by one of the researchers doing a meta-analysis is that smokers are much less likely to end up in intensive care. But then they were saying, oh, but you know, they do know better than people who are non-smokers once they get there. And made the point that, yes, because they're forced to stop smoking. So suddenly they don't have this nicotine that was possibly giving them some protective effect. And so they go downhill just as quickly as non-smokers. And there's no attempt, for example, to give smokers nicotine patches or anything like that while they're in intensive care. So I don't know whether we've got any further in whether it is nicotine or not that's having this effect. But certainly, if you just looked at the correlations, you'd think that that was something definitely worth investigating there. As strong as the evidence for dexamethasone or something in terms of being having a curative effect. So why not further investigate the possibility of smoking or in particular nicotine as being protective? But as Chris says, I mean, you know, when it comes to public health, our bad habits can't in any way be seen to be good. So they constantly deny that moderate drinking is beneficial for health because it just does not compute that any amount of alcohol could possibly be protective. And it does not compute that our bad habit in relation to smoking could have this, you know, surprising result either. But you know, we know that nicotine has quite a few beneficial effects on our bodies in terms of concentration and relaxation and whatever. So is it really all that surprising that it might actually have some protective effect against the virus?
And when you look at the enormous resources that have quite rightly gone into trying to develop a vaccine around the world, let alone the enormous amounts of money being spent on masks and PPE and all the rest of it and testing equipment, it seems to me almost scandalous that so few resources have been put into looking at this hypothesis, even if it's only to debunk it.
So, Chris, finally, do you want to give us a little update on what's been going on in Sweden? Because obviously for so many months there's been so much discussion about how this was definitely going to be a disaster, their far more liberal policy that they pursued. But unfortunately, it seems like at each turn, the facts of the matter don't necessarily meet that quite horrendous hypothesis that's put forward. So what's the latest from Sweden? How are things going there?
Pretty well. I mean, it certainly hasn't been the catastrophe that so many people predicted, including quite a lot of people within Sweden. But this has just not been recognised by people in this country who, I guess, feel the need to validate the months of lockdown. But the facts on the ground are that while cases are rising in most of Europe, they are flat or falling in Sweden and at a very low level anyway. I fully expected the number of deaths from COVID in Sweden to linger around about 50 a day for months and months and months, just to keep on going as people just gradually got the virus. I didn't think it was going to, you know, make the health system collapse, but I thought they'd have a relatively high level of mortality. 50 a day is about the equivalent of us having about 300 a day, you know. But they're down to sort of about 5 a day and have been for ages. And people respond to this by just saying, oh, well, you're only allowed to compare it with Denmark and Norway and Finland. And I don't understand why that is. It seems to me that you want to compare countries that had a lockdown against countries that didn't have a lockdown. Unfortunately, we've only got one country that didn't have a lockdown, so we've only got one control group. But surely you can justifiably compare Sweden to the whole set of countries that had lockdowns, many of which, or at least quite a few of which, ended up with a higher death rate. And it may continue because it's a marathon, not a sprint. The main issue that they don't grasp or don't try and address is that the curve, the mortality in Sweden followed exactly the same trajectory as it has in Britain and many other countries. And whereas it surely should have gone up if there's only been 10 or 15% of the population who've got it, which is the claim based on antibody tests, it should have gone up and up and up and eventually made the health service collapse, and it should have been the catastrophe people predicted. But it hasn't. It's gone down almost to zero, and now their number of cases has easily been overtaken by the likes of Spain and France. And no one's got an answer to this. I think it's a massively important question. Why did it go down from the middle of, April and went down the same rate as it did in Britain, and it's not showing any signs of going back up again? Isn't that an important question to address?
Rob, what are your thoughts on the Sweden question?
The assumption was amongst a lot of public health types is that you had to impose rules on people because they wouldn't act in a sensible fashion. But the Swedes generally trusted their population, and basically that people socially distanced for a while, and they were given the option to do that on a voluntary basis and to act according to the state of the pandemic as they saw it. And so they were able to keep the schools and restaurants and the bars and workplaces open by and large, perhaps with a few extra details in terms of how they behaved. They did that early. So they said, we're not going to lock down, but we're going to issue this advice early on, which the government, British government, didn't do. And the extent that they've had deaths in Sweden, they follow exactly the same pattern that they do in the UK, which is that half of them have been in care homes. I mean, Stockholm has been quite hard hit, as I understand it, just as London was hard hit and other major cities were hard hit. So population density is a big factor as well. And you know, that pattern that Chris talked about is absolutely there. It's just like a sharp increase in cases, and then it's decreased more slowly, but it's now got down to low levels. And that's the pattern that's repeated across the world. And it could be herd immunity to some extent. It could be that it's just summer, and there's something about summer which makes this disease less deadly, and maybe it will come back in winter. As we've seen in Australia and New Zealand, they're starting to get cases in their winter. But certainly the idea that you have to lock down and you have to enforce these things with the full force of the state rather than actually just letting people get on with it to a large extent with some sensible advice about washing your hands and avoiding crowded places and things like that, I think that Sweden has proven a more liberal approach has been effective. And if they've managed to defend their care homes and focus their resources on care homes, they will probably have fewer deaths per head of population than other countries. Unfortunately, they didn't manage to do that. One other thing is that I suspect, because it's a bigger country and it's probably better connected, that there is a greater element of international travel involved when it comes to Sweden. I know I've seen things on Twitter about the week that it sort of hit Italy was the same week that Stockholm went on its half-term holidays, and lots of people travel away from Sweden because it's cold in early March. So they brought a lot of it back, which didn't happen in places like Norway or Denmark, and that's been a major factor in the difference as well. So I certainly think it has to be explained why Sweden was different to other countries and how they've not had a sort of lost 10% of the population. Because if we don't learn that lesson, they could end up in another cycle of lockdowns, the next sniff of a deadly virus comes along, which I think would be a terrible thing, or even a locking down for a second time, which I don't think has proven to be effective at all.
Chris, you got anything you want to chuck in before we close?
It's been a great month. Been many wins. Think things can only get better. Good on Sweden. Unlucky New Zealand. Got it back on a bit of freight or something, apparently. So see that? That's what they reckon. They came in on a letter or something. I mean, it just shows the impossibility of trying to go zero COVID if the thing can travel in by post.
Well, on that note, I think it's a good place to end it. Rob, Chris, thanks so much.
Cheers.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.